We're just seeing a huge shift in the amount of carbs per hour that athletes are taking in, which is really exciting. I think that's one reason we're seeing such faster times. I mean, I think we're all elevating, but like the women's race, for example, the course arguably was a little bit longer, and the top 11 women all finished in a time that would have won last year. So,
That's so
yeah, we're
crazy.
talking about 15 to 20 minutes faster, which is a massive
That's so
percentage, even.
crazy.
That is unheard of at this level.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Yeah.
This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Welcome to our first Lifetime Grand Prix recap episode of the year. A little bit of a different format this year, which I will get into. But first things first, you may hear my voice that I sound a little under the weather. Luckily, I picked up this bug right after Sea Otter and not before. Not too surprising when you empty the tank over the course of a 4 hour, 68 mile race and then go mingle with, I think they said 70 plus thousand people at Sea Otter these days. Pretty crazy. Luckily, whatever this funk is didn't hit me too hard yesterday. And I was able to record with Hannah, our co-host for this episode. And speaking of, I'll kind of get into how we plan to do these recap episodes this year. Last year, we had all these multiple parts. We had Betsy Welsh and Ellen Campbell joining us frequently. And this year, we're going to kind of go back to a little bit more of an interview style format, kind of longer form, back and forth conversation with a rotating cast of Grand Prix women's racers. So we'll have a different co-host for every episode. And so while you will certainly be hearing from Betsy and Ellen at some point this year, we'll be doing these recap episodes with a different female participant post-race every Grand Prix. Speaking of the Grand Prix, I want to say a big thank you to Lifetime for making these episodes possible, like they did all of last year, doing the same this year. And I want to bring your attention to a change that they've made this year in their content goals surrounding the Grand Prix. New for this year, they're doing extended highlights up to almost an hour for this first one, just 48 hours after the race. So instead of the Call of a Lifetime YouTube series releasing all at once at the end of the year, the Cold Collaborative team and Lifetime events team are coming together to crank out kind of a ridiculously fast turnaround time for a piece of content that's almost an hour, super high quality, exciting, huge production value. It's really amazing what they're pulling off. And you can go to the Lifetime Grand Prix YouTube to check it out. Just like I said, 48 hours post all seven Lifetime Grand Prix events. It'll include lead up to the race content, behind the scenes interviews, highlights of how the race unfolded. You know, Lifetime and many of us part of the Grand Prix really believe that in order for this sport to grow and to build fandom, we need to take the audience inside the action. And this content will certainly do that with a live-like feel just 2 days after the events wrap up. So go check that out. You can also hit the link down below this episode or just go to the Lifetime Grand Prix YouTube account. And one more thing I wanted to add, a big thank you to Sarah Malm for being the only person to send in a soundbite from their Sea Otter experience. It's kind of funny how the engagement for the soundbite section of these recap episodes ebbs and flows. After Mid-South, we had so many submissions. We even had to have a hard conversation about whether to leave a few out because that section was getting so long, but we don't have that problem this week. Sarah, thank you so much for holding down the fort for this special introductory section of all of our recap episodes. One woman show this time, and congratulations to her for winning the 40 to 49 category and punching her ticket to the Leadville 100. And also a thank you to 1UP USA for making this soundbite section of our recap episodes possible each and every week. 1UP USA makes the best bike racks in the biz, and at Sea Otter, actually, they just released an all-new Super Duty 2024 rack, now capable of carrying 100 pounds per tray. Pretty crazy. Go to 1up-usa.com to learn more. Catch you after the show.
Hi, Payson. This is Sarah Malm from San Jose, California. I raced the Fragua XL on Friday in the women's 40 to 49 category. My race was amazing. It's been a dream of mine to make the podium at Sea Otter. I've been coming for 11 years. And not only did I make the podium, I won my age group. And the high point for me was the start. I had a very strong start and led from the gun. I was able to take the whole shot into Couch Canyon and control the race from the front. And the fact that I actually had the confidence to do so this year, it was just such an unbelievable experience dropping into Couch Canyon and realizing that I was the one that was in front. Next, I'm looking forward to trying a gravel race. I have a new gravel bike.
Okie doke, Hannah.
Let's do it.
It's Monday. 3 days post Sea Otter, I guess. I'm back in Bentonville. Got home late last night. You are in Prescott getting ready for the Whiskey Off-Road. One of the first things, I mean, we're going to dig into how your race was, your approach to the year, some changes you've made, all that sort of thing. But top of mind is how crazy the race season schedule can be, and the fact that such a huge event just happened. As we'll talk about, you had a really good race. The race is part of just a massive Sea Otter weekend that asks very much of the athletes, and yet you're already in Prescott having to recalibrate, and you have a fat tire crit here coming up in just a few days. Can you describe for the listeners what it's like to be an athlete jumping from one race weekend to the next when they're in different parts of the country and on back-to-back weekends like this?
Oh my gosh, it's such a balancing act. I mean, on one hand, I think it's really important as an athlete to like celebrate your victories, right? So you want to like stay in the moment a little bit to enjoy that because you can never take it for granted. But on the other hand, like mm-hmm. you said, we've got another race coming up. So you're like immediately shifting your mindset. I mean, the best I can say is just especially when it's good, like ride the wave, like let that joy and gratitude and success like translate into the next weekend. So you don't really have time to stop and celebrate per se, but at least you can like ride this wave. But from a very logistical standpoint, it is crazy going from one event to another. I mean, just as a visual, I think Clayton and I walking through the Phoenix airport, we had three bike bags, a golf bag because we put all of our like bike stand tools, et cetera, in like a golf club bag, and then each a suitcase. So, I mean, and each of those are like 65 pounds. So I'm carrying like way more than my body weight through this airport miles, you know, picking, and then you have to have a rental car to fit it all. Like people say traveling circus, it's like kind of overused at this point, but it's just so accurate.
It is such a traveling circus. No, I mean, yesterday Nicole and I ended up running through the airport and it felt so terrible. And I was just thinking about, because sometimes my coach is like, you know what, we really need to shut it down for a couple few days post-race. You know, you tapered into this race, had a big race. So yeah, you have some acute fatigue, but overall, you know, the training load has come down. And as an athlete, I think you can relate to this. We're always kind of wanting more, 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 especially when things go well, you want to get back into it. And my coach, and I would imagine your coach, often is kind of like telling us to pump the brakes, slow down. And it's moments when you're sprinting through the airport with a heavy backpack on your back, or you're, you know, schlepping everything you just described half a mile to your vehicle once you arrive, whatever it is. That's when I'm reminded like, oh yeah, you do really have to respect the recovery. Yeah. And there's so much extra going on here besides the performance stuff that we try to really finally control. Yeah.
Was great. Like the day after Sea Otter, you know, you race almost a 5-hour event. You go through all the podium, all whatever, you know, excitement after. So most of us are like elevated to the point where it's not like we're in bed at 8 p.m. Okay, right? And then the next morning I'm up at 7 a.m. for a photo shoot. Then we go to a meet and greet and then to a giveaway and then to an autograph signing, another filming, a second filming, you know, and then probably like a sponsor dinner or something like that. So, I mean, yep. I found myself literally from 7 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. the day after the race, just on. And then you lay down in bed and you're like, huh, I wonder why I can't sleep.
Yes, it's so true. It's so true. I mean, last night I was so tired. We got to bed at, I don't know, 12:45, 1 a.m. And I just laid there awake for another hour and a half or something. And yeah, I'm not going to be training hard today. And I didn't have hard training planned today, but if we had, it probably would have gotten canceled.
Yeah, so it's just an ongoing balancing act for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit, speaking of scheduling and everything, let's talk about how you've adjusted things this year. You've been one of the athletes over the last couple of years that have juggled as hectic and ambitious a schedule as just about anyone. You've basically pursued the highest level of bike racing in the United States and the highest level of mountain biking globally simultaneously. And this year you've changed things a little bit. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the last couple years I've balanced World Cup XCO racing and also the Lifetime Grand Prix and what feels like everything in between. So that's everything from short track races, which are 20 minutes, to, you know, nearly 8 hour races in the Grand Prix. And gosh, it's like, if you know anything about physiology, then people will understand that that is not only very difficult to pursue from a physical aspect of what does training actually look like, but then you layer in the logistics, all the extra travel, you know, it's a lot of training days lost to travel, and then the mental side too, you know. And I think as we see these races get more competitive, things are getting more specific too, you know. And so people are showing up for these events not just fit, but fit for these extremely specific courses. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's been a really challenging balancing act for me. I wouldn't change it for sure. But over the last couple of years, I've kind of been watching and seeing where I feel like my specific niche is. And I think I really have a knack for these long events. I mean, you'll probably laugh because you've been telling me that since we were teammates in 2020. Yeah, but, you know, I think I do have a knack for these long events. And these last 2 years, I've been watching the Grand Prix prove itself on the biggest of stages. And it's proven itself to me as well. And so I've really pushed all of my cards towards these longer endurance events. I've shifted my training fully to focus on these longer endurance events. And that also gives me the bandwidth to get more specific for these events as well. So I'm super excited about what this season will bring. I mean, the last 2 years in the Grand Prix, I've managed a top 10 both years, but without ever giving myself a drop race. And oh, wow. It hasn't been like without, you know, oh, I've just gotten lucky. Like, we know I've had a separated shoulder, concussions, mechanicals, you know, so it's really just been gaining these top 10s through pure survival and grit. Yeah. And we still know anything can happen, but I'm really hopeful to actually put my best foot forward this year and finish feeling like, now that's the best I had, not what if.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, as someone who's focused solely on the Grand Prix the last, or I should say primarily on the Grand Prix the last couple of years and seen how challenging it is just to train for the diverse types of races within the Grand Prix, it's really crazy to think that you are adding a whole other dimension of difficulty to that. Because, you know, I talk to my coach all the time about the trickiness of trying to be really explosive and good for a 2 hour Schwamigan and also have the diesel engine for a 10 hour plus unbound. But that 2 hour Schwamigan, which feels so short within the Grand Prix, is, you know, 30% longer than an XCO.
Yeah. And
you know, five times as long as a short track. So without giving too much away, are you willing to share just a little bit of how you've adjusted training this off season in light of this?
Yeah, I mean, my coach, I feel like, has really shifted things up, which is super exciting. I think, I'm sure you understand as an athlete how motivating it is to get to a start line feeling like you've made measurable changes that can therefore have measurable outcomes. And I think, you know, on the most basic level, just looking back at my training peaks from last year, I mean, I had raced nearly 10 times by sea otter. So it was yeah, I know. So it was just like travel day, off day, rest, race, recover, like travel, like, and it just looking through it, it's like, oh my gosh. I mean, of course I'm training. I'm doing the best that you can. But when you're racing every weekend, you don't have time for those huge blocks. Yeah. And so that, I mean, that's the first huge thing is we, without racing so much, we've been able to put in really specific huge blocks where I feel like I've actually hit that overload and that super compensation. I've definitely trained more hours than ever before, which is very exciting as well. Instead of just doing like, you know, one or two massive 30-hour weeks, it's like trying to actually sustain something more like 25-hour weeks over and over and over. And, you know, while of course we're going into sea otter and you need that VO2 for especially the start, which I'm sure we'll talk about, you still need a lot less than in XCO racing. And so shifting that focus a little bit away from VO2 anaerobic efforts and focusing more on, okay, we're going back to raising my FTP again, focusing on threshold, focusing on sweet spot, on fatigue resistance, and all of that stuff. So yeah. Pretty big shift, to be totally honest.
No, for sure. And yeah, it's interesting. It's a common misconception that racing a bunch actually results in lost fitness oftentimes. It's counterintuitive because you get more tired because of all the things we described at the beginning of this conversation, but you also start to lose fitness. And obviously on the road side, it's very different because so many of those races can be used as really stellar training camps because of the nature of the racing. And
well, on the road, it's like they're back to back to back in the same place, right? So it's like you're saying, it's like a training camp. But on the mountain bike or on the gravel bike, if you want to race many times, you're traveling at minimum across the country. And no matter how dedicated and focused and organized you are, an all-day travel day is an all-day travel day. And that's a training day lost.
100%, 100%. Yeah, one of my curiosities this year is about some of the riders who are going to be combining some road schedule with the Grand Prix. Like Toby Rode, for example, who's new to the Grand Prix, is just coming off of Redlands. And I was really curious to see whether he was going to be, you know, showing some signs of fatigue or just absolutely ripping after, you know, a week long stage race. So that's the other thing. Interesting thing about the Grand Prix is, kind of like you, people's goals are constantly ebbing and flowing. And, you know, some of the top riders are really going after the Belgian Waffle Ride series simultaneously alongside the Grand Prix, and other riders will just do barely anything outside the Grand Prix. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk about sea otter. For those that have listened to the recaps from the past year, last year we had Betsy Welsh and Ellen Campbell often co-hosting me and helping me throughout these. We'll certainly be getting their input off and on throughout the year also, but we wanted to restructure things a little bit this year and have basically a guest female host for every recap episode and have a different female host for every episode, because obviously I can provide plenty of insight into the men's race, but having a rider that was in the women's race obviously gives us insight that I could never have or Betsy couldn't have. So thanks for providing that insight.
I'm excited.
I know you wrote down a handful of things, but I think first of all, we should quickly describe the challenge that was set before the riders course-wise, race dynamics-wise, all that sort of thing. The Sea Otter Classic has gone through the all of the races, but the cross country race has gone through all kinds of iterations over the 15-ish years that I've been attending. I think you said you've been going nearly that long as well also, right? Since you were a junior racer.
Yeah.
And I remember years, of course, when it was a very like traditional XCO style race and all the top World Cup racers would come over. And then there were years where it was more of like a big super loop. But this is now, in this era of Sea Otter, by far the longest XC version we've had. It's a legitimate marathon at 4 to 5 hours and almost 70 miles, huge amount of climbing, over 8,000 feet of climbing. We cover, I think, a huge percentage of the available rideable terrain in Fort Ord now. It feels like we touch almost every trail and every road that they can use to an extent. The map is really crazy looking. But can you quickly walk us through the lap, just kind of giving us a few highlights and key points?
Yeah. So, I mean, the Sea Otter start, you'll hear over and over, is a really critical aspect because it starts on the track. And after that track, it goes into single track. And by the track, I mean the Laguna Seca Raceway, where the cars typically race. So it's wide open at the start, but it's only wide open for about 3 minutes. So it ends up being a 3 minute all out effort and a race to the single track, because once you hit the single track, it's single track for about 15 to 20 minutes. There's some significant descending in there where you do not want to be stuck behind someone who's apprehensive on the mountain bike. And while you can maybe make a pass or two, you're not going to come back. You're not going to make a massive comeback from that start. So that first, I would say, 25 minutes of the race is a really, really critical time. After that, I think the course, you know, becomes, it goes in and out of single track. There's some steep climbs. It's actually pretty punchy throughout the race. There's a long flat section where there could potentially be opportunity for groups to work together, although I think it's pretty rare that they're actually able to organize. And then it ends with another 15 to 20 minute climb that starts in single track and ends up on the Lookout Ridge climb, which is pretty infamous. It sort of ratchets its way up all the way to the finish before we have, you know, a 3 minute or so descent to the line.
Yep. Yeah. And overall, you know, the surface is pretty sandy. To me, it felt a little tackier this year than last year. Did you have any opinions on that? Any observations there?
I mean, to me, I feel like Sea Otter's just, it's always, it's an interesting one because people will say, oh, Sea Otter's not that technical, but it's so high speed that it really is. We see a lot of crashes there. It's like you're saying, it's sandy, it's loose over hard, but it's also really rutted. And you get these weird little water bars and ruts that come across the trail that can grab your front wheel. And when you're crashing at that high of speed, it's also can be a detrimental crash to have that early in the season. So
can be a bad one.
I do think it's still a course that definitely favors a mountain biker over, you know, road cyclists or gravel racers specifically.
Yeah, I agree. Did you make any significant changes to your bike setup with kind of the unique aspects of this course in mind? Like, how would your bike setup compare to, say, Leadville?
Yeah, it's funny. I took kind of a similar approach to Leadville because if you look at the profile, like mile for mile, there's actually a lot of climbing at Sea Otter. So personally, I feel like a light bike is still super important. So I did run a hardtail, which was different than a lot of the field, but I felt like the lightness was important. I had the new Fox 32 step cast, which is also like a half pound lighter than its previous version. So again, like focusing light, light, light. But because Sea Otter is still so chattery, such high speeds, like lots of cornering, for me, like the two big things that were like very, I couldn't compromise on was one, I think a dropper post, at least for me, is super critical mm-hmm. on this course. Mm-hmm. And then since I was on the hardtail, I wanted a little extra traction, more volume, a little lower tire pressure. So I ran a 2.4 tire.
Yep. Yep. Interesting. Yeah, everyone had new suspension at this race. Both the RockShox athletes and the Fox athletes had new improved suspension. Okay, so we got this kind of surprise announcement from the race a day or two before that there was going to be no tech support. So that meant no wheels in the pit. It meant if you flew a mechanic out to help you, unfortunately, that mechanic couldn't do anything other than hand you bottles. We were given these kind of neutral drop bags where we could almost like desert island style put whatever items of value that we could think of into this drop bag, and then the drop bag would be transported to these aid stations. We were staying at the same house. We were at the Valet house together. We were kind of laughing about how weird the situation was and that we'd never come across this, like, what shall I put in my desert castaway bag to my survival essentials? And we both kind of decided that there wasn't a whole lot you could throw in there really that would make sense. But how did you go about with your putting together your insurance policy per se? Did you do anything special beyond the typical tire plug, spare tube, CO2, chain brake sort of situation?
Well, I stressed about it more than usual.
same.
Honestly, I think, like you said, it's like at first I felt like I was going to have all kinds of things. And then when it actually came time to have that drop bag, it's like, well, I'm not going to do a massive change out there on the course. Like if something catastrophic happens when you can't have a mechanic out there, the reality is your day is kind of over. So I think my insurance policy was just, I definitely rode more cautiously. And maybe some of that was because I've had a crash at Sea Otter, I've had mechanicals at Sea Otter. And so really wanting to have a clean race. But I mean, I don't know about you, but I definitely left stuff on the table when it comes to the descending. I just feel like if you're riding above your limit or even at your limit at Sea Otter, you are asking for mistakes because you're also riding so close to people.
Yeah.
And these like rocks and ruts come out of nowhere. So more so than usual, I was leaving extra space and I was pretty comfortable just with using momentum or a couple extra pedal strokes to close that for the insurance policy of knowing like I am not risking, you know, a mechanical, at least unnecessarily.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that just reminded me one of the huge deciding factors of Sea Otter is just the group dynamics, because the average speed is deceptively high, you know, 15 to 17 miles an hour average, which means take out the steep climbing sections. You know, when you're riding in a group, you're over 20 miles an hour for a huge percentage of the race. And we saw, you know, that in regards to that role, the role of that and how the race has played out with these big groups kind of coming together and splitting apart and coming together. And so it is very much a mountain bike race, but it's about as tactical a mountain bike race as you get. You know, it's in my opinion, it's right up there with Leadville in regards to a mountain bike race that has a ton of sort of gravel tactic influence.
Absolutely. And we definitely saw that in the women's race.
Yeah.
For sure.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about how the women's race played out and you can give us specifics about how your race played out.
Yeah. I mean, I guess so. The overarching view is we started up the track and Sophia led the attack as one might expect.
Did you expect that actually?
I did. I didn't expect her to be go it alone, but I definitely expected her to be the one to set the pace. I think that's just kind of her MO.
Right off the, right on that big pavement climb off the back, you saw that coming.
When it went steep, she was the wheel I was looking for because I knew she would be the one to set the pace. Yeah. Okay. But she got a gap pretty, like, she had 15 feet by the time we entered the single track. And for me personally, from Sea Otter's past, I wasn't extremely stressed about that because usually it does come back together because it is typically a group chasing a person and that group will often make that adjustment. So she had a little bit of a gap across all of the single track, and she continued that gap out of the single track, which is when I started to be a little bit surprised. As we entered, you know, now we're talking about 30 minutes in, Alexis, who had had a less good start for her, asked me, is anyone up the road? And I said, well, Sophia is. And immediately Alexis just jumped off the front.
Wow.
She was very dedicated to that move. And I had a moment where I thought about following and hesitated because it just really felt like, you know, at this point, Sophia had 30 seconds on the group and we're a group of five and she's one off the front.
How far in is this?
Like 30 minutes in.
Yeah. So right. Yeah. Had you finished, I think it's called Cow Canyon. It's this really challenging single track section. Technically too, because it's a very narrow, kind of overgrown. There's some ruts. But you sort of climb out of this little valley canyon, get up on the ridge, and then you take this right-hand turn, and it's this crazy high-speed rolling.
That is where this is happening.
Okay, yeah.
That's where this is happening, exactly.
Wow,
yeah.
That's
really And so
really
Alexis
amazing.
Actually attacks there. And in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, this early on, I'm actually okay with someone dangling out front because
yeah.
I feel like our group will work together, catch them, and then they will have expended the energy that we didn't have to.
Yep.
So I was trying to make a smart technical decision. Kudos to Alexis for attempting that. But I think we did see that it also caught up to her. So Alexis made that jump and then Alexis continued to dangle a pretty, you know, she got about 20 seconds ahead of our group and it took a long time to get ahead of that. So she was dangling for a long time all alone. And that's all across that long flat section. The problem is while I think our group was very motivated to catch first and second, Sophia and Alexis, I think everyone wanted to do it alone. And or I think the other issue is no one wants to be the one to put out more effort. Because the problem in these group scenarios is if I go to the front and I pull really hard for 2 minutes and then no one else matches that, well, now I'm on the back foot in the group.
All of the progress you just made gets nullified.
Goes 100%. Yeah. And so it's almost this trust element of, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm trusting you to then also do it. Because the other thing, while we definitely want to contend for first, and that's all of our goals, we also don't want to end up last in our group, mm-hmm. which would have put you seventh.
Yep.
And so you're kind of playing with all of these dynamics, and that's why the gap grew and diminished all throughout the race, is seeing are we racing each other or are we racing together? And coming through the first lap, Alexis and Sophia had come together and we were 35 seconds back.
Wow.
So with 33 miles to go, 35 seconds feels like, personally, I didn't feel like that was a lot. I felt like we were in a great position.
Yep.
But as the miles ticked down, I think so did the idea of sizing each other up.
Mm-hmm.
And so the opposite actually started to happen where Haley Smith came from behind and actually caught our group mm-hmm. with maybe 10 to 12 miles to go. And that's when I think everyone starts realizing what has happened, that we have now started racing each other instead of pushing for that group. And so at this point, that is now the storyline, is now we are racing each other to the finish for that third place position. I started to ratchet up the pace on that as the single track climb started. And when we exited, Samara was the only one who could attack out of there. So she attacked. I followed her wheel. We were together much of the lookout ridge climb. She started to gap me a little bit. And then we could both see Alexis's jersey up the climb. And Alexis, I think, having made that very gutsy move early, she was out of matches.
Yeah.
It was pretty clear, you know, a Samara passed her a few seconds later. I passed her a little bit later. Haley Smith passed her, all in the last 1 to 2 miles of the race. And when that happens, you know, you are just riding on fumes.
Yep.
So very exciting to finish out that way. So to make it clear, Sophia won. She was able to maintain that lead. Samara second. I was third. Haley Smith fourth. And then Alexis came in fifth. So I think super dynamic race and really interesting to see how all of those tactics impacted those final miles.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, what you just described in beautiful detail is just classic group two syndrome is what we call it.
Yep.
And
yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing when that kicks in, how much it can shape a race. Alexis went for the win. Like, she went for it early and paid the price. And the fear of having that happen is what kept your group, you know, potentially not cooperating quite as much. And
absolutely.
There's a good chance that, along with having a lot of confidence in her strength and fitness, Sophia had a good idea that group two syndrome might happen if she was the one that put pressure on everybody early. What's interesting is in the men's race, we had group one syndrome, which isn't actually technically a thing, I don't think, but the pace was so on and off again, and there were long periods where we were literally just freewheeling, looking at each other, and there were the typical kind of like natural separations that would happen in the single track. The first time coming out of that Cow Canyon section before the high speed descent, where you mentioned Alexis made her move to try to bridge up, we had a long line of maybe 20 plus riders, and I was just on the wrong side of a split, and being on the front on that section is the last place you want to be, obviously, because it's so high speed, you're pushing so much wind, and everyone behind you really doesn't have to do anything. And so it was a group of, I want to say, 10 in front, and then a group of 8 or so in this next group. And I've done Sea Otter enough times to know that if you don't make a junction there, it could be game over. So I made a calculation, like, this is going to require a lot of energy, but you have to get this done now. So was one of a couple of riders that went super hard and bridged back across to that lead group, knowing that there's that little single track section afterward, the descent, where you can kind of recover a little bit. But that that moment that you described with Alexis is so key, and it's deceptive because it's a gravel descent, really high speed, after a really hard climbing section. And I remember talking to Petr Vakoc after the race, one of the newcomers to the Grand Prix, who was caught out in that section because when he pre-rode it, he thought that was going to be an area where people kind of looked at each other and recovered. But there's this weird acceleration that always happens on that section for whatever reason. And riders like us that have done Sea Otter a bunch of years know that. And we're able to kind of be on the front foot of it. But it's these ebbs and flows of Sea Otter that I really love. You know, it has all the fun aspects of mountain biking with technical descents and bike handling really mattering and challenging sand pits and fun single track, but also these group dynamics that can decide how the race plays out just moment to moment.
So in the men's race, when you're in a group of, say, 20, you know, 20 men all lined up through single track from first to 20th, that has to be 10 seconds.
Yeah.
So that's like a pretty significant line.
Yep.
So are you all sprinting for every single track? Because it does open up several times and maybe like a big, I'm thinking particularly of that big road climb with that tight right hand turn. Do you all just hammer for that to try and get in like those top 5 to 10 spots for good positioning, or does it sort of sort itself out naturally?
You know, it's interesting you ask that because my my assessment of that evolved over the race. And at first I was a little bit stressed about it and, you know, really fighting for position and trying to make, you know, get in the middle of the group at minimum versus towards the back. I knew I didn't want to be at the front. I really wanted to try to hide and save matches. But at first I was worried that the group was just going to continually be exploding. But something that was kind of unique is that there were riders at the front. It seemed like, especially Keegan, was really shutting down the pace at times and like intentionally, not straight up blocking, but bringing the pace down and wanting a more tactical race. And so eventually I stopped stressing about it too much because it seemed like our group really wasn't going to explode further until much deeper in the race. And in fact, we got caught by a group of four right after the end of lap one, starting lap two, which was Vakoch, Toby Rhodes, Zach Calton, and Taylor Ledeen. And I think that just says a lot about, you know, how negative the pace was in a way at times. But then there would be these huge ramp ups in pace. And one exception was Matt Beers would always go to the front in the, I can't remember, is it East Garrison? That kind of like neighborhood area at the far end of the course.
Oh.
Yeah, so you've finished the kind of fast, false flat, gravel road descending, little bit of pavement, and then you're in the swoopy, tight single track. It's deceptively hard. It's got these like grinder punch climbs in it, and he would always go to the front there and just kind of string it out. And that's an area where I felt like positioning actually was more important because the accordion effect was crazy. And he would stay on the gas for a good 20-minute chunk of time. And if you were towards the back, the whiplash you were getting of having to accelerate back to the group out of these tight turns and over the top of the climbs took its toll for sure.
And do you think that was smart of Matt? Like, do you think that was a good move because that plays to his strengths? Or do you think that burned matches that he then did not have at the end?
It's a really good question. I'd love to ask him that, but I think to an extent that's how he has to ride because his strength is one of his strengths is that he's just this massive diesel engine and he can just sit on such a high power for such a long period of time. And he did end up hurting, you know, the 7 or 8 of us that ended up not making that final selection of three, which was he, Alexi, and Keegan. So if nothing else, he probably kind of solidified top three for himself. But by being the aggressor there, he potentially dented his chances at winning or second.
Okay. Yeah. And you also said another thing that kind of just caught me off guard. So Taylor Ledeen, he finished 6th, is that correct?
Yeah.
And you said that he actually had to catch the group.
He wasn't even the lead group for the first 70% of the race.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think happened there? Do you think he just got caught behind and was really on one or?
Yeah, I think he probably was on the wrong side of that initial split that I was describing on the high speed gravel descent. I know he's a very steady diesel rider, a lot like Matt Beers, actually. You know, he's won Unbound 350 a couple of times, I think. He's won 24 Hours in the Old Pueblo a bunch of times. So his depth is really impressive. He's a great bike handler, and he's just in amazing shape right now. And so I think he rode a much steadier race and just rode like a very complete race from start to finish. And all of the punchy accelerations that were happening in the first lap when it was on and off and on and off in the lead group, you know, maybe being in the lead group wouldn't have even been an advantage for him. I don't know, because of the style rider he is. I'd love to ask him that. But yeah, I remember, so going up Lookout the last time, it's funny because I was in a bit of a, I don't want to say negative headspace, but I wasn't feeling super optimistic about how things were going to shake out because I was battling cramps pretty hard. And then all of a sudden, like you were describing with Alexis, you see riders. That's the thing about Lookout. It's literally a lookout ridge. Like you can see
yes.
forever. And so you see your competitors, you know, stacked up and you can take visual time checks. Okay. That one's at 12 seconds. That one's at 17 seconds. Mm-hmm. That one's at 25 seconds. And if you have just a little bit more gas in the tank, you can really chase down some riders. So even though I felt like I was starting to fall apart a little bit, I made up 3 spots, I think there. But Taylor was behind me just lurking.
Oh,
and maybe 10, 12 seconds behind. And I was like, man, I have a lot of confidence in my late race game, but if there's one person, I don't want to be in a low speed, you know, death march battle with, it's Taylor Ledeen.
Yeah.
And sure enough, he rode back to me and we actually ended up working together a little bit to solidify those placings. But anyway, nice. It's a really good point. Like as in terms of maybe unlikely rides, based on where people were after the first lap, I would definitely put him up there. Like he made up so many spots from the first lap to the second lap.
Well, and he's not in the Grand Prix. So that was definitely, I think next year, that's a great result to for his chances of being in it next year.
Well, that, and you know, he's a rider who is super humble, maybe mm-hmm. a little bit more soft spoken, but an absolute competitor. And you know, that was on his mind. Like he was riding with something to prove, and he absolutely proved something. It's really awesome to see.
Yeah. Another one I'm curious about, Alexi, you know, we see him up there all the time. So while I'm not surprised, also, you know, he's not the typical mountain biker. And I think he's done a lot to improve his skills in the last few years. But did that ride surprise you at all from him? And do you think, like you're saying, maybe Keegan was slowing down the pace or others were slowing down the pace or controlling the pace, being the right word, mm-hmm. in some of the single track sections. Do you think that in a different scenario with different race tactics, you all could have really smashed some of the descents and put him on the back foot? Or do you think he's just elevated his riding to a point where he's good to go for it all?
I think he's elevated his riding, honestly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, maybe we could have ridden a couple of the descents a second or two faster, but there's a little bit of a speed limit on a lot of those descents. Like,
yeah, I agree.
If you're a confident bike handler, if you're one of the confident bike handlers, like there's not a whole lot you can do to really pull out extra time because of that kind of sandy surface, because it's pretty tight, because it's pretty blind.
It's so blind. I think that's a key feature, is like, because it turns so much and it's so overgrown, there's some sections where you can only see like 10 feet ahead. Mm-hmm. And when that's all you can see, I personally feel that the speed has to be in check because you just don't know what's around the corner.
Exactly. One other thing about Alexi is he was racing a full suspension mountain bike for the first time that I've ever seen him race a full sus.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And, and I was behind him. So there's kind of, in my mind, like the longest and I don't want to say most technical, but like the descent where maybe you have to pay the most attention. And it dumps you out. It's like 2 minutes long, and then it dumps you out on the long, false flat, gravel downhill before you start kind of the tight, it's so hard to describe the course. We need like,
it's really hard.
I don't know. It's like mile 20, maybe. There's a descent that's noteworthy. And I was behind Alexi, and he didn't lose any time whatsoever to the rider in front of him. And at no point was I like, I'd like to go a little bit faster right now. He was just one of the mountain bikers shredding at a mountain biker speed on this key descent. And I rolled up next to him because inevitably after that descent, there's a little regrouping because people are kind of like eating, looking around, not wanting to pull through. I was like, Alexi, you're a mountain biker now. And he's like, man, full suspensions are awesome. I understand why you guys are always riding them.
That is so funny.
Yeah. One thing, man. I will say about Alexi, though, just to finish that topic, is his ride did surprise me, actually.
Okay.
Not because I thought he would be hamstrung by bike handling skills or anything like that, but because last year, taking a slower build into the year, both in terms of training and it seems like mentally served him really, really well. I mean, we saw him win two Grand Prix rounds late in the season, finish second overall, have some absolutely incredible rides. And so I sort of expected him to maybe have a similar approach and not stress about chasing a big Seattle result. And I saw him here in Bentonville a couple of weeks ago for part of his From the Ground Up project. Mm-hmm. And his attitude was very relaxed. He was having a great time, having a couple of drinks, not stressed about spending a few days fully hands-on with these campers. He wasn't thinking about like, oh, I have to rush out the door and squeeze in my interval session. And so I thought he was taking a similar approach. And one of my big questions is maybe he is taking a similar approach and he's just even better this year. And well, what is that going to look like later in the season?
Yeah. So I think he won't be at Unbound.
Right.
Because his brother's getting married. Yep. And so I think on one hand, he says it's making him maybe a little bit more relaxed because he has less expectations since he's missing a race that suits him really well. But on the other hand, if you're missing Unbound at Sea Otter, like you have a long time until Crusher. And so why not set yourself up for a super good race there? You know, push all the chips to the center of the table because you have time to go back, pick up the pieces, reset, and be ready for the second half of the season. So I also think that could have served him really well too.
Yeah, totally. I mean, as competitors, we're not going around announcing to each other, I've trained super hard for this race specifically.
Exactly.
Like there's a very good chance that, you know, he did prepare a little bit more in a little bit more focused manner.
Yeah.
For Seattle this year than last, but.
And then lastly, I think the other one notable that's not a ton to discuss, but Russell Finsterwald, we would have expected to see him at the front at this race in particular, but he had a flat that apparently took him 10 minutes to fix. So it sounds pretty significant.
Yeah, sounds like your day last year.
Yeah, seriously. So my heart goes out. But, you know, given what he typically does, this likely could be a drop race for him. And as I would still consider Russell a mountain biker at heart, maybe not was the race he wanted to drop, but I'm sure he'll still come back strong from it.
Yeah, you know, it's just unreal how much changes year to year. Like, he almost won this race last year, like was just a couple of bike lengths away. And it's just a classic example of how bike racing giveth and taketh away. And you really have to just be, you have to let it take from you. And then when it's giving, you know, like you're talking about with your big third place finish, you know, you're absorbing that right now and kind of reveling in the success, but you just never know. Any other storylines from the women's race? I think we'll rattle through the results and kind of the standings, and then we're going to transition into some listener questions, kind of rapid fire style to finish this out. But any other storylines from the women's race you wanted to hit on?
Yeah, I don't think we have to go into like massive detail on any of these, but just a couple things that I think are interesting to keep in mind for the rest of as we continue into the Grand Prix. So one is that Erin was up there. I think she was, seventh? She's a mom. She's training 10 hours a week right now. So,
Unreal.
Yeah, big kudos to her being in that group for probably one of the least amount of training of anyone out there currently. That said, she probably maybe has more hours of training in the legs from her career as a whole than anyone else. So that's an interesting one. Melissa Rollins was 10th. And I think she's a road racer. I mean, she has mountain bike experience, but I think road is really her bread and butter. So to pull out a 10th at a race that maybe wasn't going to be her biggest result, that is setting herself up for a really great Grand Prix. And then I also wanted to give a shout out to some of the younger riders. Michaela Thompson, she was in that front group for the first lap. I think she ended up maybe 12th, I think. But she was in that front group. So anytime someone gets in that front group, like, that says that they're like on the cusp, right? And then also Anna Yamauchi, she was 13th, but she specifically has been saying that she's starting her season more conservatively to finish it stronger. And so I think that's a great result with that intention in play. And then probably the last thing to bring up is just a few of those riders in the top did race the Cape Epic. Mm-hmm. So Sophia, but she's done it so many times now that I think she has a pretty good grasp on what that takes. But Alexis and Samara were new to the Cape Epic, and that can go a lot of different ways. It could have been the absolute perfect training they need to have a great load to crush it all season long, or it could have put them a little over the top, peaked them well for this race, and then maybe it's possible that someone could struggle with some fatigue later on in the season from that. So both experienced riders, I don't anticipate that, but I think it is still an interesting storyline to watch.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, those are all really good call-outs. Well, let's just rip through the standings. So Sophia first, Samara Shepherd second. Also, is she Australian or from New Zealand?
New Zealand.
Okay. Hannah, our dear co-host, third. Haley Smith, fourth. Alexis Scarta, fifth. Jenna Reinhart, Aaron Huck, Sarah Sturm, Haley Preen, who I believe is also new to the Grand Prix.
South African, also did the Cape Epic, was fourth. Yep. In the Cape Epic, yeah.
Melissa Rollins. Is it Melissa or Melissa?
Melissa.
Melissa Rollins, Deanna Mails, Michaela Thompson, new to the Grand Prix, Anna Yamauchi, Crystal Anthony, Peter Mullins, also new to the Grand Prix, Ellen and from Australia. Australian national champion, maybe?
In like 17 time.
Oh my God.
It's a ridiculous amount. I actually found her when we were pre-riding, and I asked her about that, and she started listing. I think she even has one in like mountain running or something. Oh, wow. Where I was like, what? Yeah. So sounds impressive, like athlete for sure.
Sounds like a good podcast guest. Yeah. Ellen Campbell, Cecily Decker, also new to the Grand Prix, Leah Vanderlinden, Kristen Legan, back in the Grand Prix after taking last year off, Caroline Torrey, Emily Newsom, Lauren DeCrescenzo, Kate Cross, new to the Grand Prix, Sarah Lang, Danny Shrewsbury, and Sarah Max was the last point scorer. And then we kind of have our IR list, injured reserves. We have Anna, Anna Hicks, new to the Grand Prix, had a really tough crash and a crit a couple weeks back where she, I think, broke her scapula. You might remember.
Scapula, collarbone, and first rib.
Ugh, had a little pneumothorax in there as well, I think. Yes. So really beat up. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll make it back for Unbound. Heather Jackson, I'm not sure if she was a DNF or didn't start. Do you know
on that? I think she didn't start. I know she was at, I think she was at the Unbound gravel camp. So I think she just had other priorities to start the year.
Got it. Paige Onweller, who's out with a nasty ankle injury, but on the comeback trail and on track to start Unbound. And Lauren Stevens, who I didn't see at the race. I assume she's over in Europe doing some road racing. She's kind of doubling up on a crazy schedule, I think.
Yeah, I would assume. And crazy schedule aside, she's definitely one to watch big time. She has a huge engine.
And this is her first year doing the Grand Prix, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. That's exciting. She's absolutely one to watch. Okay. And on the men's side, Keegan, right back to where we're used to seeing him, leading Alexi, where we're used to seeing him. Matt Beers in third. I think Matt was actually disappointed with his ride. He's a very humble guy who, you know, isn't one to, be all flamboyant with how he's feeling about things per se, but he kind of alluded to wanting more, which I completely understand. I actually I don't think Keegan will take this personally. I picked Matt to win this. I just thought off his Cape Epic performance and with the style course, he had a really good chance to win.
That's why I specifically asked if it seemed like he maybe burned too many matches, because he was one, I think, that was possible for him to dethrone Keegan. But, you know, it's a long season.
It's a long season. And the thing is, with a race like Sea Otter, you run that race 10 times and probably get three different winners over the course of the, mm-hmm. the 10 races. You know, it's there's a lot going on with it. Cole Patton, fourth. Brendan Johnston, fifth. I'm sixth. Zach Calton, seventh. Also, shout out to Zach. He was in that group, that second group that bridged up. Also, shout out to him on a new big partnership with Yeti. It's really good to see him. You know, he's one of those young riders who we've had him on the podcast. You know, he fellow Utahan with you. He, you know, has bounced around a little bit, having to hold down grown-up jobs here and there while maintaining a really high performance level over the last few years and racing at a professional level. And with the opportunities that are coming with this Grand Prix, he's able to do it full time now and have a real career. So it's really cool to see him, you know, signing new deals and being able to chase the dream. Howard was eighth. I'm not going to give too much information, but I have a little bit of insider info that he won the Cape Epic with Matt Beers.
Yeah.
I hope Howie will come back on the podcast. He's not someone that loves being in the media, but he's one of my dearest friends.
So curious what you're going to say, because I got to speak with him the day after the race, and exactly what you're saying. He's quiet. He's humble. He doesn't, you know, throw out a ton of information. So I feel like what he told me about his race was just like, gosh, just scratching the surface. But maybe he opened up a little more with you.
So... yeah, so, I mean, I'm just so happy to see him have that huge success at Cape Epic, and I was really curious to... He was another rider who I really expected to see on the podium at Sea Otter, and I didn't hear this directly from him. I heard this from his roommate and another really, really close friend of mine, so I'm not going to give too much away, but he's been dealing with a little weird, like, overuse injury since Cape Epic that has made it so that he wasn't able to train normally at all the 2 weeks post Cape Epic. So I think there was probably just like a little bit of rust, and he looked really, really good up until Lookout Ridge. And when I went past him halfway up Lookout in his very nice Howie way, he just said something like, "Nice one, Peso," or "Good job, Peso." And I was like, "Oh, Howie, thank you, but I feel for you too." So, okay, Howie eighth, Petr Vakoc ninth, new to the Grand Prix. Someone who I think will be knocking on the door of winning one of these this year, and I expect to be fighting for the overall podium often. Had him on the podcast not too long ago. Sean Fincham, who is Andrew Lesperance's teammate, Canadian, had a solid ride, comes from an XCO background, making his first transition into kind of focused on marathon and gravel for the first time. Toby Rode, who, like I said, was coming off of Redlands and was maybe just showing a little bit of signs of fatigue from that. Also, I know got tangled up at the start. Alex Wild back in the Grand Prix after not being in it last year, had a solid ride, but seemed like the wheels just really came off for him right at the end.
Was he in the group? Because he's one who, living there, I think typically has produced a really impressive Sea Otter.
Yeah, he's been really consistent there. Yeah.
Yeah, but he also has experienced some difficulties in the end of the season, so maybe he's playing it a little slower this year to start out.
I don't know. He was racing really aggressively in terms of positioning. He was definitely one of the guys that was fighting for every corner to an extent. I don't know if that caught up with him a little bit at the end, but he basically just came up, you know, 20 minutes short on the energy side of things. Finn Gullikson, new to the Grand Prix, but really showed big potential last year at a lot of the lifetime races that are in the Grand Prix, and got the opportunity for that reason. He was in the lead group, and not only in the lead group, but he was, you know, sometimes you see these young riders come in and you can just see their hunger, and he wanted to be on the front at times. He was looking to show everyone that he belongs and that he has the legs. He came off the back of that group about halfway through the second lap, but looked good. Lachlan Morton was 14th. Andrew Lesperance 15th. I think he just had a little bit of a rough day. He was yo-yoing off the back of our group for the first lap. Braden Lang had a flat. He was in the lead group looking really comfortable until I think he cut his tire on some glass or trash or something. It was down near that neighborhood area. Dylan Johnson, 17th. Pete Stettin, 18th, who I know was coming off of a cold. Kyle Trudeau, Carter Anderson, new to the Grand Prix. Truman Glasgow, new to the Grand Prix. Lance Hydette, who started the season really, really strong and I think has good form, but maybe was just a little aggressive off the line. There's a funny photo of him fighting for the hole shot up that pavement section with, to my eye, way too much of a pain face going on. you know, maybe it was just a funny shot, but I had in my mind, you know, be in okay position, but don't overextend yourself here. And it looked like he really wanted that hole shot. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that caught up with him or what. Chase Wark, 23rd, new to the Grand Prix. Fenstey, 24th with that flat. Nathan Spratt, 25th. Jordan Schleck, all the way from Uganda. Looking forward to catching up with him on the podcast soon. 26th, Jack Odron, 27th. And then our finishers with 0 points, John Borstelman, who crashed hard and had a bit of a concussion, but seems to be okay. Alex Howes, who started, didn't finish, and I'm not sure why. I haven't talked to him. And Logan Owen, who I didn't see start the race. So I don't know on that one. And that's what we got. Do you have a minute to chat over some listener questions? Just rapid fire
style? Yeah, let's do it. Okay. Yeah.
We've covered a lot of it. I know you're an absolute fueling strategist, as we talked about before the race. Mm-hmm. How do folks run only one bottle for a lap of Sea Otter? I think that might be a little bit of a misunderstanding. Someone might, the person here might think that we're only drinking one bottle for the entire lap. But there are 3 aid stations per lap where you can take a bottle. But can you describe how you calculate how you're going to fuel, both in terms of hydration and carbohydrate for this race?
Yeah. So like you said, there's 3 feed zones on course. So you actually have the opportunity to have three or more bottles per lap, depending on how many you're taking in the feed zone. And then what's in that bottle can be obviously anything you want. So I'm counting carbs in bottle plus carbs in pocket, and I'm doing carbohydrates per hour. And we're just seeing a huge shift in the amount of carbs per hour that athletes are taking in, which is really exciting. I think that's one reason we're seeing such faster times. I mean, I think we're all elevating, but like the women's race, for example, the course arguably was a little bit longer because of the finish.
It was longer,
in the track.
For sure.
Yeah, okay.
It was at least, it was at least, in my estimation, I would say it was probably between 2 and 4 minutes longer.
Yeah.
Per lap.
And the top 11 women all finished in a time that would have won last year. So,
that's
yeah,
so crazy.
Absolutely that's insane. Yeah. I think we're talking about 15 to 20 minutes faster, which is a massive percentage even. That is unheard of at this level. But I think it's just all of these little things adding up. And I know for me, at least, you know, 2 years ago, I was fueling at 60 grams of carbs an hour. Last year, I bumped it up to 80 grams of carbs per hour. And in Sea Otter, I was taking in 110 grams of carbs per hour out there. And that's between fluids and also my liquid shot gels. So yeah, I mean, we are eating and drinking what feels like near constant out there. And I think that's also what you can tell on Lookout Ridge when people are really imploding. I would argue that it's not just fueling at the end, but it's how they've been fueling since 20 minutes in, or maybe even breakfast that morning.
Yep, absolutely. I'm going to tell a little funny story here about Hannah, actually. So before the race, we were talking about, again, because we were staying at the same house, we were talking about fueling strategies a little bit. And you mentioned that you were going to be getting a lot of your carbohydrate through food rather than through your bottles. I said that I was going to be doing it mostly through my bottles, and you mentioned that you were going to be doing it mostly through your food, because if you missed a bottle, you knew you wouldn't be set back fueling wise. You would only be down food and not fluids and food. I missed a bottle towards the end of lap one. But because of our conversation before the race, I put an emergency gel in my back pocket. Literally, as I was heading out to warm up, I was like, I remember what Hannah said. I agree with her. I need an emergency gel.
Yeah.
So I was down 60 grams by missing that bottle and down some fluids. But I made up about half of it with that gel. So thank you.
Awesome. Glad I can help.
I just very quickly, because of your mention of the race times, I'm pulling up the men's results here and comparing last year to this year. So the men also went faster this year, but it wasn't like a massive percentage like you're mentioning. But what is interesting is how much more closely packed everyone was. Give me just a second here. Okay. So last year, between 1st and 15th was 12 minutes. So give or take a minute between each finisher. This year, between 1st and 15th was 15th is sort of throwing off my point here because there's a big gap between 14th and 15th. We'll do 1st through 14th, 6 minutes. Okay. So basically, instead of a separation of a minute on average between riders, there's a separation of 30 seconds between riders. So it was twice as tight, really.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I think so much of that is fueling.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question. More specific. What's up with the downhill right-hand corner everyone crashes in year after year?
I honestly don't know where this corner is.
Me either. Okay. I see video of it every year and I'm like, where is that corner?
Shannon even tried to show me on the map and I do think you can still look at watching it. There's sort of like this rut / water bar almost like bump that's at an angle.
Yeah.
And what's just happening is it's taking people's front wheel. Their front wheel is following the rut along the side instead of coming straight over it. And that's a variety of things. It's body position as well as having strong arms. I think a lot of the time, like when we're descending, we'll get really loose to let the bike do what it wants, which is good. But especially in really loose sandy stuff, you have to still have like a pretty solid upper body, because otherwise the bike will just take that. It'll follow those loose ruts and it'll take that front wheel. And once that front wheel turns, there's absolutely nothing you can do.
Yeah. Yep, I know. And literally the film, it's at the point where the film crew has like a nice camera set up
there, I know,
to capture the crashes. And I don't have the faintest idea where it is. I also, this is going to be slightly controversial, but it seems like the roadie killer corner, because every single person I see crash has been someone with a back, a drop bar background. So I don't know what the story is with that, but evidently it just has the perfect ingredients to catch people out.
I know. I did watch, that's where John crashed, and I did watch his video many times trying to figure out exactly what was happening there.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I hope everyone is okay that went down in that corner. Let's see. Let's do maybe one more. This is kind of funny. I don't even really know how to answer this, but it's a broader question, and I am kind of curious about your answer. It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but finishing rank aside, would you still rather do this than a 9-to-5 desk job? So I think what they're saying is, even when you have bad races, even when the lows of racing are really low, which, you know, when you pour your heart and soul into something, that's going to happen, is it still better, in your opinion, than a 9-to-5 would be?
Oh.
Do you have much context to answer that? Have you had a 9-to-5?
I have not had a 9-to-5.
That's
which
the
is
thing.
Kind of like, funny. But I think it just, it's a matter of passion, you know? Like, maybe it wouldn't be for everybody, because some people love their 9-to-5. But for me, I love I love racing and riding my bike more than anything else, which means even on the bad days, it's going to be the best thing that I could be doing. And I think keeping that perspective is really important as well, because yeah, like on the bad days, it is super brutal. And as cliche as it is though, those bad days are what make the good days great. I mean, that was, for me, I've had some bad luck at Ciata the last 2 years, and that just made this year even better. And it means that I don't take this result for granted at all, because there are going to be bad days, and that's okay. I think there's also bad days at a 9-to-5 desk job.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's something we can both relate to in regards to Sea Otter. Is I had such a dark few days after Sea Otter last year, because when you pour your heart and soul into something and it just goes really poorly, no matter what the job is, no matter what the passion is, that's going to hit you really hard. And I think that would be overall my answer too, is I think this job, although on paper it looks so incredibly unusual and different than traditional 9-to-5s, it shares a ton of elements of a traditional 9-to-5. I mean, we're on a video call right now. The number of meetings and you know, complicated schedules you have to juggle is really significant, and you know, contracts and paperwork and so many emails. That there are aspects that are very much like a 9-to-5, but we're getting to do our passion and what we really, really love more than anything else. And so it absolutely isn't for everybody. You know, I think there are, it really gets glorified. And I think there are many people for whom it would not be as fun as maybe they think it would be. And vice versa, you know, there are maybe more traditional jobs out there that I'm curious about what it would be like to try for a day, and probably it wouldn't be for me at all. So I think we're just lucky to have found what we're really passionate about, and that's what people should strive for sure.
100%. Absolutely agree.
Okay, Hannah, we've only gone 30 to 45 minutes over, so I think I should probably let you go.
This is great. Thanks, Payson.
Thank you. Good luck at Whiskey. I can't wait to follow.
Yeah, thank you, and good luck at the Traca.
Thanks. Talk to you soon. Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. I hope you enjoyed that recap episode with Hannah. Big thanks to her for coming so prepared and having so much to offer. I really, really enjoyed just kind of going back and forth with her on our respective observations from our races. You know, it's obviously, I can give you a tour behind the curtain of what it's like in the men's race, but can't do that for the women's race. And so we will certainly be prioritizing this style format moving forward. We'll work in more Q&A component in the future, I think. She and I really found a flow there. So episode ended up being longer than we expected and didn't have time to dive into as many listener questions as I thought we might. But do let us know what you thought. Is there something from last year's recap episodes that you miss, that you would like for us to try to carve out some time for and work in future recap episodes? As a reminder, the next one will be Unbound Gravel, first week of June. Speaking of the Grand Prix, a big thank you to Lifetime for supporting these recap episodes and for churning out such awesome video highlights just 48 hours after the race has happened now. They've restructured the way they're doing things this year too. Instead of the Call of a Lifetime YouTube series being released all at once at the end of the season, they're really leaning into kind of newsworthiness and striking while the iron is hot and making sure that y'all get an inside look to the races right after they happen. So they're releasing long form race highlight videos on YouTube now, just 48 hours after the races wrap up. And they'll cover the lead up to the races, behind the scenes interviews, highlights from how the race has unfolded. And all this is because they really believe that to grow the sport and build fandom, we need to take you, the audience, inside the action. And they've partnered with production company Cold Collaborative, who I've spent a lot of time with. We did the White Rim film together way back in the day, and they just do an awesome job quality-wise, production value-wise, and these days, timeline-wise. I just can't believe what they're cranking out 48 hours after the races. So go to the Lifetime Grand Prix YouTube page to check out the Sea Otter extended highlights, or click the link below this episode. I want to say a big thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing the show each and every week.
I keep calling her Lily McKelvin. I don't know. At one point, I'll retrain my brain to say Lily Hardman. But she did get married last summer. Also, a big thank you to Nicole Baker for producing the show each and every week. And thanks to all of y'all for listening. If you'd like a little visual to go along with this audio, you can always go to the Adventure Stash Instagram and also play our Friday quizzes for a chance to win a pair of Adventure Stash socks. Really fun moment at Sea Otter this past week when one of our sock winners came by the Orange Seal tent to have me sign the socks she won last year. Pretty fun. All right. Thank you all so much for listening, and we will catch you later this week because we do need to catch up on episodes. Right now, we're running a week behind, and we got to get back on that never missing a week schedule. So look for a new episode before the week is out. Catch you then.